Yesterday, I was thinking about this really great spoken word thingy. I'm not sure what you call it, but it's a poem that my friend wrote and performs about how people that are passionately seeking truth and seeking good things in this world could actually kind of come together in conversation and maybe, you know, work through differences and learn from each other and share, and how they could grow through that experience of conversation. And fortunately, my friend who performs, who wrote that poem, is here today. So I asked him to come to perform for you. Would you invite Nigel with me up to the stage? You know Nigel, he's our Canadian friend from the north, and this is his last week with us for the summer, and maybe for a while, we'll see. We don't know when we'll be back around, but so here is him performing his own piece.
Thanks, Lucas. all right, so this piece is called Harvest, or An Exhortation to Outcasts. When it comes to spitting your mind from your mouth, the sentiment spills into scenes and the saliva sprays are in fact a sacrament. And spring is just appearing after endless winter months have graced the stage. And we have long been caught in the rib cage of an ice age. But we have not waited in vain. Frozen, yes, but ever thinking and ever dreaming, waiting to be thawed out in 100 years and put on display in the National Museum. Amongst the sarcophagi and holy books and Rosetta Stones, we will be historically significant when we awaken. Each of us is a crucial part of the cacophony, active and electric participants in the symphony. We are movements, and we are being conducted together. I don't believe that you are what you eat, because despite the steady diet of notebook paper and napkin scrawl that has been ingested by my kinetic and unrelenting soul, I have yet to become stationary. We are seasons. We are not becoming extinct, only changing our clothing accordingly to suit the weather. We adapt. Call us earth shakers, record breakers, the brand new lawmakers. The scientists, activists, strugglers, and haphazard courageous, sleeping on street corners and in care homes and in spare bedrooms. We are the tag-alongs and the late-night fiction readers, the cheekbone shiners and the nosebleeders. We are the Halloween ghouls and the Thanksgiving pilgrims. We are the sleepy tea time and lullaby-loving citizens of the hometowns we all have in our back pockets. We are the spirits who will visit you at midnight on Christmas Eve. We are here to open our mouths in order to unlock eyes and ears, our own notwithstanding. We are Cuban cigars and aged scotch on the rocks, letting the fireplace warm our woolen socks, getting up to answer the door every single time opportunity knocks. Books open on our bedsides, our Tolkien's, Tennyson's, Neruda's, and chicken scratch love songs to all of our various proof rocks. And still, I invite you further. Step outside the powder room and walk past the barren hillsides and skeletal branches of the things you used to believe in and come be my guest. Warm your hearts at this hearth and feel the heat of truth and kindness permeate your body and let yourself soften. I long for us to learn how to warm the wintry places inside of each other, revive one another. And I know people love their cars and credit cards, but part of my disregard, sympathy for civilized society is harder when part of me is still in the garden, under the arbor. When winter scatters, I'll be searching the sky for patterns and coming alive soon after. When springtime gathers and summer lingers, see, I have big, big plans for the harvest, to fill up my larder with wine and stories, good conversation, shared experiences. Worship songs, good round potatoes, pieces of paper I've dreamt upon, sheet music I saved from the fire, beautifully charred around the edges, but not forever, shoes with worn out soles, unable to take me any farther. Why don't you come over and enjoy the warmer weather? I can tell you humorous anecdotes while we sip tea on the veranda or sit back with biscuits and molasses in the parlor. We can talk about how people around us are mountains worthy of our expeditions. How rightness can look a lot like being wrong, and maybe insight is useless if we can no longer hear the beauty of somebody else's songs. This is the promise of the thawing out of hearts who are locked up like lifetimes of sunshine in December, wanderers and farmers alike. This is me throwing wide the cellar doors and letting the voices pour out, setting them free without remorse. I can hear them calling to all of us every day. They're saying, may the road rise to meet you, and may the wind be always at your back. May the rain fall softly on the fields of your relationships. May you be cradled in the palm of the Lord God Almighty, and may your arms together, one and all, be strong for the sowing and reaping that is to come.
Well, I hope you have a great service. Have a great week. We'll see you around. Today is an introduction service to the series that we're going to be doing over the next few weeks called How to Fight Nice in a World Gone Mad. And as I just like pay attention to the news or my Facebook posts or, you know, just the world around me, I notice that this world has a lot of problems with each other. And it seems like it's getting worse and worse. It's like it's not possible to live in our own little bubble with people that believe the same thing we believe. We are constantly faced with people with different opinions and different viewpoints, and we have to figure out how do we work well with each other. And if that's not just in the world at large, it's actually in our own families. I was reading about this relationship researcher, John Gottman. He's really respected because he spent all this time studying relationships. He put cameras into people's homes, well, with their permission, and he would just spend thousands of hours watching people's interaction. And he learned so much from that he actually was able to, find out, like, how did they make it in marriage? Did they get divorced or not? Whatever. He could actually predict within 5 minutes of watching people interact with each other with 91%, correct guessing that whether or not they're going to make it or not, get divorced or not. He could actually just see how well they interact and how it works between them to see how well they're going to do in life. And here's some surprises from what he found in his research. One surprise is that fighting or arguing itself is not predictive about divorce. You know, this idea that whether you fight or don't fight, that actually doesn't say anything about if you're going to make it in a marriage or not. It's how you fight that determines it. He says there's the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four major problems that you'll find in a bad fight. One of them is criticism. So criticism is not just like a complaint about someone's behavior, but is actually criticizing who they are, their personality, or just their lifestyle, you know, how they're acting, their character. Another one is contempt. Contempt is that more deep, visceral kind of disgust we have maybe towards someone else. And it comes out through the rolling of the eyes or sarcasm or whatever, but we have contempt. That's really bad. Defensiveness is really bad, where we just feel like everything someone says is something, you know, against us, and we're so sensitive. We can't actually hear what other people are saying. And another one is stonewalling, or actually like pretending there are no issues, not listening, not kind of going there, just, you know, maybe someone else's problem, just blame shift or scapegoat. But those are the four problems he sees in people's relationships that could cause major problems. Another surprise, he says, is that most couples who do well and last, never resolve their differences. That's actually, you know, a little bit of difficulty here. You think, oh, no, we're going to get through this. We're going to figure it out. Gottman says, no, actually, most disagreements can't be resolved because they're rooted in fundamental differences between people, between their lifestyles, between their personalities. I have a friend of mine who actually is a professional life coach, and he uses personality typing to help people understand how to be better at business or be better in relationships or in life. He says that the best marriages are people with the same values but the opposite personality. That is not just that, you know, opposites attract, but actually that's what makes the best kind of relationships. Gottman totally agrees. He says the problem is you have to figure out how to, you know, appreciate one another's differences, how to understand that what's going on inside of us and actually, you know, honor that and respect those differences. I notice these differences as a pastor. I actually help a lot of people talk about their relationships, as they get ready for marriage or as they have problems. And I've noticed that there are often, not every time, but often, like one person who is an early morning person and one person who's a night owl, one person who is, 5 minutes is late and the other person is just always late. One person's a planner, one person's creative, one person is spend, and another person is save. There's just these differences that often actually work together in a relationship. Introverts, extroverts, following through all the time, starting new all the time. My wife Laura and I definitely have those kind of breakdowns in our relationship. But I think actually having kids has kind of heightened the differences in our lives, or at least we're exposed to new things that we didn't know that we're different about. One of them is actually, some of you might know, I'm a little wilder than Laura. Okay, yeah. I'm a lot wilder than Laura. But I'm actually the safety person, at least the physical safety person in our family. And so if Laura, installs the car seats in the van, I go and I double check and make sure that they're all installed the way that I want them to be installed. It's not that Laura is inept or unable to, install things well, or she's definitely not, unsafe. She's safe. But, I just think it's so important that you double check that. I'm always looking for where things could go wrong physically and trying to make sure things, don't happen bad. Laura, on the other hand, is way better at emotional safety than I am. And so, if I'm putting the kids in the car seat, they're squirming, they're trying to get a toy and they're doing everything. I'm getting frustrated and mad. I'm just pushing them in there and they're putting every buckles on, make sure they're physically safe as I'm getting angry at them. And Laura is just, she's so patient. She's smiling and singing a song, with them. She just does it much differently to me. And so I've learned, I've watched her. Sometimes she's told me hey, relax a little bit, maybe try this with them. And I think I've changed. I think I've actually gotten pretty good at this whole emotional safety thing with our kids. I've improved in that area. And Laura, she's always safe. I think she's gotten hyper safe, to my liking. Maybe I made her worse off. I don't know. But actually, this is what I want in our family. And so we've learned to honor and respect our differences like that. At the same time, we still irk each other all the time along those lines. I mean, we do. Especially if there's extra pressure, if you're going to a big event, going to a wedding, and there's time pressure, and all of a sudden, it's just like we default to our old ways of doing things, and so we get steamed with each other. And so we have to learn how to actually, have unity in our relationship with these unresolved differences between us. I think that's true for all relationships, for friendships, for roommates, for church relationships, for just in society at large. I think as I think about how God plays into all this, my assumption is that God would actually make people better at this, that religion would actually help people hold together some kind of love and unity. And as I look around the world, I feel like, man, is that really happening? It doesn't actually seem true. Religion, the root word is ligar, which is meant, is a word used in ligaments, to hold together. But you see religion actually pulling people apart, actually causing some of the biggest problems in our world. And yet Jesus seems to be all about this, holding together, this unity, this connection with other people. That was the biggest thing he was into. There was this biologist who's an atheist who was saying that his two big heroes in this world are Charles Darwin, because it makes sense to the biologist. He says Charles Darwin taught us that we're all from the same place and so forth. But he said the second biggest hero is Jesus, because Jesus taught us to love our enemies. And that's the thing that we need to have to be able to make it as a human race. And I think, man, that holding together enemies, even loving our enemies, that's actually what the series is about. That's what I think Jesus is really into. We're going to be looking in this series into Romans, the book of Romans, written by this guy named Paul, particularly chapters 14 and 15. Today, we're going to look at chapters 14, 1 through 12. And this is written in a time when there's a lot of conflict in the world. It was not a conflict-adverse culture. And yet, Paul, this guy who's writing, is really passionate about this idea of holding us together. So let's take a look at this. It's chapter 1. It'll be on your screen, also be in your half sheet if you want to follow along there. Chapter 14, verse 1. Accept the one whose faith is weak, without quarreling over disputable matters. This is a really important phrase for him. Another way to translate it is debatable matters. One person's faith allows them to eat anything, But another, whose faith is weak, eats only vegetables. The one who eats everything must not treat with contempt the one who does not. And the one who does not eat everything must not judge the one who does, for God has accepted them. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To their own master, servants stand or fall, and they will stand, for the Lord is able to make them stand. I think the root in that word stand is the same that's used in resurrection. So this idea, God's actually going to bring about life in their life. He's going to bring them all the way to the end. One person considers one day more sacred than another. Another considers every day alike. Each of them should be fully convinced in their own mind. Whoever regards one day as special does so to the Lord. Whoever eats meat does so to the Lord, for they give thanks to God. And whoever abstains does so to the Lord and gives thanks to God. For none of us lives for ourselves alone, and none of us dies for ourselves alone. If we live, we live for the Lord. And if we die, we die for the Lord. So whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. For this very reason, Christ died and returned to life so that he might be the Lord of both the dead and the living. You then, why do you judge your brother or sister? Or why do you treat them with contempt? For we will all stand before God's judgment seat. It is written, as surely as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bow before me, every tongue will acknowledge God. So then, each of us will give an account of ourselves to God. There's a lot of wisdom, I think, in this passage. And yet, it's something that I think we need a little help to be able to figure out what he's saying. He's writing to a particular group of people with particular problems and a time period that's, a long time ago from us. And so there's some translating we need to do from the context and from the culture of that day to our context and our culture. Otherwise, we'll be making up our own meaning as we read this. So hopefully, we'll get a little bit of that. First of all, this letter is written to a particular group of people. A third of the New Testament is letters written to people. Some of them are general letters for a whole bunch of people to read. Other ones are to this city, like to Rome, to the Romans. And a lot of that theology, a lot of the things that we learn from it, the spiritual practices and the wisdom, the morality in there, we learn on the fly. Right, because it's written to a group, and this problem, this is how you deal with it, and we need to figure out what their problem was and how Paul was teaching them so that if it relates to a problem we have, we could kind of translate it well, and if it doesn't relate, figure out what do we do with that. So we're learning from these letters on the fly. This letter was written in 57 AD or CE, whatever you prefer, but it's pretty understood that that's when it was written by Paul. This is written 20 years after Paul had the biggest mistake of his life, this really profound event that happened to him. And it's something that I think just really marks all of his writing, particularly this, that if we don't understand what happened to Paul, then we won't get what Paul is saying. What Paul did was he was this really religious guy, and he was using what he understood from God to persecute, to put people in jail that were following Jesus. He thought was a false Messiah. So he's putting Jews in jail and people were being killed because of that. And what he figured out in the end, it was he was using his beliefs to harm other people. He was trying to help other people, but he's actually harming other people. I identify with Paul. I think it's really important to identify with Paul in this kind of way. I think God needs to kind of let us know that we've harmed other people with our beliefs before we really get, or at least aware that we could do that. I think everyone does this. I think of this guy, Richard Dawkins. He's a biologist. He's another atheist. And he's brilliant. And he writes really well. He has a lot of great things. I like to watch his videos online. Except when he starts talking about religion, especially when he's talking to other people, like in these like debates or whatever, because he just comes across so mean. He has contempt, obvious contempt for anybody that believes in God. He wrote this book, God Delusion, and he just is really mad about this. And I think everybody, atheists and non-atheists alike, actually feel like this guy's just a jerk. I don't want to be around this guy. He's so smart. I like what he says, but man, who wants to eat dinner with him? I think that kind of comes across, and so people just feel like embarrassed to have him on their side if he's on their side. Well, I feel the same way often with churches and with pastors. My friend Ken Wilson, who I'm just robbing all kinds of ideas from, he actually shared a story about something that happened to him. I thought it was a really great story, so I wanted to share it. He said when he first started as a pastor a long time ago, he found out that he had to marry people. That was part of the job, and so he had to figure out, okay, when do I marry people? What people do I marry? How do I go about doing it? And so he studied the Bible, and he was really, he's a you know, kind of scholarly person. So he did a lot of research in the Bible and what people wrote and just try to figure out, okay, how do I do this? And he came to the conclusion that the only way to marry people is if they hadn't been married before. That if someone was divorced, they have to stay single. He will not remarry people. That was his stance. And some people believe that, and some people don't believe that. But he had this conclusion. A couple came up to him and said, we would like to get married. She had been divorced. She was a single mom. He had never been married before. And he said, well, I'm sorry. Actually, I don't marry people that have been divorced. And they said, okay. And they went to another church and got married and were part of that other church. He said, years later, that couple showed up in his church, and he saw them and recognized them. And he said, hey, could we get together? And they set a date to get together. And the morning before he got together with them, he was praying, and he felt like God just called him out and said, you know, the way you treated that couple all those years ago was totally wrong. You just kept them at arm's length. You just had your conclusions. You had your point of view, and you didn't get involved in their life, the messiness of their life, and try to figure out and try to listen to me in the moment and try to discern what's right. You just had your point of view, and that was it. You really did them wrong. And so he felt convicted, and he went to meet with this couple, sat down, and he told them, you know, I got to apologize for the way I treated you all those years ago. You know, I don't know what was right or wrong with your marriage, but, I mean, I just felt like the way I handled it was wrong, and I'm so sorry. They started crying. They said, you know what day today is? And he's kind of like an absent-minded guy. He's like, I don't know. It's a Thursday, Friday? I forget. They're like, no. It's our 25-year anniversary. You know, and so it means so much for you to say that. He felt like God was saying, yeah, like, I affirm this marriage all these years later that this was really, really right, actually. I think, you know, I've been busted like that so many times. I was thinking back to how when I first started being a pastor and had to speak publicly in front of people, the things that I was saying, I'm so embarrassed by them. I think I was just trying to, like, impersonate some, like, pastors that are, like, big churches, and they're really cool. I want to be like them. And so I'd say things that were just mean, or I just put down, like, other churches, like, that church, they do it wrong because of this, or that church does it wrong, and that church, and now, like, if I see someone that visited our church just at the beginning like that, I feel so embarrassed around them. I'm like, that's not really who I am, you know, let me tell you what I really believe, and, you know, I just feel like, man, I use what I thought was right to really harm people. I just got busted by God. I think we need to understand that's Paul's thinking behind before we could actually understand who Paul is and what he's trying to say here. In this year, in 57 AD, the Roman church that he was writing to was going through a huge readjustment. 7 years earlier, in 50, Claudius, this emperor at the time, actually expelled all the Jews from Rome. And so even Jewish people that are following Jesus had to leave. And so Nero, 7 years later, lets him back in. Nero, this is before he becomes this really evil guy. This isn't a nice Nero. He says, come on back in. We need the Jews. They're helpful for our culture and society. Come on back in. And so as the Jews are returning back to Rome, the Gentile believers, Gentile people following Jesus, had to figure out how to get along with all these Jewish followers of Jesus, because they didn't have to. They didn't have to work on that. And they actually were pretty connected to the culture in Rome. They felt like, you know, they had pride in being Romans. This is a big part of who they are. It's kind of like, you know, Christians that have this American pride, this national pride that's connected. They felt like they're in this place. They appreciated it. The Jews did not feel that way. They didn't have any of that connection. There's always big cultural differences, moral differences, religious differences between these two groups. So Paul is actually trying to fight for unity in this group of people following Jesus that have all these big differences. And he uses this argument that this is actually a sign that Jesus is who he says he is. That Jesus, at that time, they understood that the bigger the king is, the more power he had to hold together different groups of people. And he said, Jesus is the biggest. This is what he came to do. This is what it's all about, trying to keep these kind of divided groups together. And this actually goes back, it has a sense of the Old Testament of the Bible, these prophecies about what the future is going to be like when God's in power, or what heaven is like. And this one comes from this prophet Isaiah, and he's talking about this day when everything is all set right by God. It says that God will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many people. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. And so this idea Paul is saying is that future, that time when God just makes everything right, that got started here with Jesus. Jesus is making this thing happen. Jesus taught his followers to pray, "Let your kingdom come, God. Let your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." We want a taste of this heaven now. And Paul is saying, this is how we go about getting a taste of heaven now. This is how we beat your swords into plowshares. This is how we have unity in the midst of unresolved issues or disputable issues. This, I think, the reason I want to go into this talk is I just think, man, it's critical for churches in general or just as people in society to understand how to work through these matters. It's becoming locally a political season. And if you're Facebook friends with local people, you start seeing people support this candidate and make a snide remark about that candidate. And I think political seasons really heighten this whole problem for us, because I know as a person that has opinions about political things, I tend to look down on certain people's positions, and I try to argue these things, and it just takes extra effort to kind of beat my sword into the plowshare at this time. Paul actually, I think, offers something that helps us to be able to do this category of disputable matters. This recognizing differences between other people. And I think he gives us three perspectives on how to actually work through this, how to actually have unity in midst of division. Number one is this. If you want to fill in the blank, this is your first fill in the blank. Remember who is and who isn't the judge. And it's capital J, judge. That's not Mike Judge. Remember that cartoonist? That just came to my mind this moment. But in verses 3 and 4 and 10 and 12, he's really hitting this heavy. He's not being light about this. He's saying, who are you, right? Who are you to judge? Who the heck do you think you are to judge someone else's servant? You are not the judge. No. You don't have the right to tell people what they need to believe and what they need to do. Say, no, each of us answers to God for our own stuff. The second one is, imagine how the person on the wrong side of the issue, quote unquote, your wrong side of what you see it, might be there for the best possible reason to honor God. So in verses 6 through 8, he kept on saying over and over again, people are doing this to the Lord, and people are doing the opposite thing to the Lord. People with different points of view are doing it for the best possible reason to honor God. And number 3, we don't have to give up our convictions to stay together. Paul is actually saying the opposite. He's saying, be convinced of whatever matter it is. You should think about it. Later in this book, he writes, if you do something without the conviction, it's sin. You need actually the work to be convinced. I think there's a lot of neat psychology Paul is using. This first point and the third point, I guess both of them, they both are saying to you that things matter. Often whenever I have a strong opinion about something and people come along and start talking about having unity, I just feel like they're saying things don't matter. There's no real right, there's no real wrong, it doesn't really matter what you believe. I'm like, no, it matters. And Paul is saying, no, it does matter. You have strong convictions for a reason, things matter. The thing is that God is going to be the judge, right? And God's going to be a judge because God is going to sort things out. He's going to say, this is right, this is wrong, he's going to figure this out. But God's going to do it, and it's going to happen in the future. You have to have patience. You have to give it time and allow God to work through all that. He'll sort it out. As a pastor, I thought my job is to have the Bible sort out all of the people's problems. This is how you figure out that. And certainly the Bible does do that, and we're teaching from the Bible, and so it's helping us to figure out how to do things. But if you look around, you realize that actually the Bible has been used by a lot of people from different points of view and actually has made the waters muddy at times, right? This is saying God is going to sort this out personally. God is going to take the job of actually working through all these problems. The second point I think is just really good for our souls. This idea of kind of giving people the benefit of the doubt. As we think about our own perspectives and our own beliefs, we often give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. We think, even if I did something wrong, I did it with the best intentions. My motives were good. I was doing it because I thought it was right at the time. I actually think that 20% of what I believe right now is probably wrong. It probably is. 20%. I'm just probably totally off. And if I knew what that 20% is, I would change it. But I don't. So I'm going to try my best with not knowing everything that's right. So I'm okay with being wrong. The hard thing is actually we don't get to have the same access to other people's hearts. We don't have that same perspective. And what Paul is saying here is give people that benefit of the doubt. Give them the same sense that their motivations are good, that they actually are doing things because they think it's the right thing to do. And so he's calling things disputable matters. He's trying to help us think about this. What might these disputable matters be? He gives us two examples, food and holidays. Food and holidays, you know, eating meat, sacrificed and whatever, and different worship days. That seems like it may be a silly issue. I think, you know, we don't tend to argue about that stuff all that much. I mean, of course, we maybe argue about it a little bit. I've been in circles where the idea of celebrating Halloween was a really, really bad thing for churches. Don't celebrate Halloween. You have your harvest fest. You have something else. And it's understandable. The idea, well, it's a pagan holiday, and it's involved, you know, witchcraft and things that, you know, churches don't believe in. So we don't worship. And other people, hey, it's silly. It's costumes or whatever. People have different opinions about holidays. And certainly when we're talking about the holidays in here, there's a lot of holidays that they could be talking about. This idea of food is also a hot button issue for some people. Whenever I've done discussions with people from diverse backgrounds in our church, we talk about, like, what do you think about speaking different languages in a church service? Or what do you think about, you know, all these different political perspectives in a church? And we actually could, like, work through them pretty well. The one thing that we keep on having problems with in our discussions is communion. How to actually have what is called like the Lord's meal together. Because people have these strong opinions about you do it this way, you don't do it that way. And that actually could be like the strongest kind of disagreement in our church. While food actually does have a lot of, you know, and it's like a meal in a sense, have a sense of like different beliefs about it. Some people have strong beliefs that, you know, you don't eat meat raised in factories, you know, abuse animals and treat them hard. You know, like it's moral progress to actually consider that. And other people think, man, we have some like bigger moral fish to fry, to use a bad pun. You know, like you know, it's silly. You know, food is not our hottest hot button issue today. We have a lot more big things. In 57 AD or CE, these were the hottest hot button issues of the day. These were like the first order, like the big things that people were fighting over and be having disunity over. These, why? Well, food for two accounts. One, because God's people at that time were distinguished based upon their food practices, the kosher laws. A lot of people in churches don't think about kosher laws so much. They thought a lot about it at that time. It wasn't a settled issue. In the New Testament, you see a lot of disagreement. You see Jesus saying, well, all foods are clean, and Peter having this vision that kind of confirms that. And yet, even whenever the Gentiles and Jews were having disagreement, the apostles in Jerusalem said, okay, we don't want to make all the Gentiles do all the things that Jews do, except for these three things. One of them being, don't eat meat with the blood still in it, which was a hallmark of being kosher. They're saying it's still important to be kosher to some extent. This is a big role. So this was a hotly divided issue at that time. The second reason food was really important was it was a controversy over the first commandment out of the Ten Commandments about worshiping other gods other than God. Because at that day and age, almost all the food that was all the animals were sacrificed in a way that was connected to temple worship of pagan gods. So they'd invite like the god to be involved and like get the power of the god as you eat this food, and it was worship to these other gods. And so these people are saying, you know, if you know the Bible at all, you don't want to worship other gods. You don't eat this food. It's much better to eat vegetables than worship these other gods. It was a big, big issue. And the same thing with special days. Again, special days, we don't have that much of a problem with worshiping on Saturday or Sunday or whatever it is. But actually, those are big issues. Sabbath was one of the Ten Commandments. And so people thought a lot about it. It was a hot button issue of the day, as in the other holidays. So as I'm reading Romans 14, I just want to encourage us to not let ourselves off the hook of thinking, oh, these are about minor issues that, you know, we've kind of resolved these issues. They're not that big of a deal. No, these were about the things that we haven't worked through yet in our time and our place. These are the things that are trying to pull us apart. These are major, major issues. And so if there's strong stakes on an issue, then that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about the light things that we don't really bother too much about. We are missing the punchline if we think about it like that. So Romans 14 is trying to make us squirm in our seat in some way, shape, or form between us and other church people, or us and our relationship with other people in our home or friends or however it is. I want to kind of give you just a quick kind of definition of debatable issues from an emotional point of view. Next week, we're going to talk about debatable issues from more of a rational or logical kind of point of view as we look into it. But in this sense, here's the fill in the blanks. Debatable issues threaten to tear us apart because They involve our sense of loyalty to God. So if it doesn't actually make you feel like, I don't know if I'm really like on God's side or not, then it's not maybe a debatable issue. You know, it really threatens that. It threatens our sense of loyalty to the Bible or to Scripture, to God's law, right? We're like, what do I really believe about that, what the Bible says? It involves a sense of loyalty to our cherished tradition. And it is involving our sense of loyalty to our family, whether it's a natural family or spiritual family. The way that debatable issues actually interact with other people are primal, deep, kind of heartfelt issues. I actually think what Paul is making a case for in all of Romans, particularly in here, is that outside of the power of God, outside of God actually helping us feel connected to Him, that us kind of making a stance on controversial issues is how we feel like we're right. We feel like, man, like, am I really doing things well with God? Well, at least I have this stance. At least I believe the right things. And Paul over and over again is saying you can't hide behind your religion. You can't hide behind your beliefs to actually know that you're connected with God. You actually have to have God Himself in your life. You actually have to have Him work in your life. So that's what we're talking about with the debatable issues. I want to close with just thinking about how we actually could start working through this stuff together as a church, or working through it, you know, individually with other people in your life. How do you actually to deal with debatable issues? The first one is to get emotional space by giving your unresolved issue to God. Get emotional space. Again, I think, you know, we're thinking mostly today about the emotional feel of these debatable issues. And if you have an emotional stance politically or over, you know, which way the toilet paper should go, I really feel strongly, I do. If you have like a strong emotion about one thing involved in your life, it's hard actually to actually see the other person's side or actually to deal with it well. We actually will just be destructive in how we kind of deal with it, because there's all the heat of the moment, all that heightened sense of what we feel about that. I know when I first started following Jesus in my early 20s, I was a biochem major, and I'm, you know, reading the Bible, and this is before I realized there's different literary genres in the Bible and how it all works out. If I'm reading like Genesis, I'm thinking, this is contradicting science, you know? How do I actually handle the seven-day idea of the world being created, and how do we work through that, especially what I'm hearing in churches? It's all a certain way, and that just doesn't feel right, or how I understand the world and science. What do I do with that? Is like my whole faith in jeopardy because of how I feel about this experience, this doctrine. And I was encouraged, just give it to God. You know, just relax a little bit. And I did. I was just kind of just like, okay, this is too smart for me. I wasn't there at the time. I don't know how it worked out. Let me just kind of like let God handle this bigger problem for now. And as I've given it some space, I was able to like think about it differently from different points of view, and over years kind of come up with a sense of what I really think has happened. And I think the whole Christian world has kind of moved in the way that they think about it. And it's just things have changed, and it's been helpful just to kind of give it to God. The second thing to do is to give it to God again and again and again. And that's because I just think, man, because it's emotional, it's sometimes hard to control how we're feeling. And so the emotion just comes back. And we're just like, man, I'm just still upset about this. Just every time we get that feeling, just give it back to God. Say, God, again, you're smarter than me. You take care of this issue. And I think what we're doing is we're beating our swords into plowshares, right? That's actually what's happening when we do that. And you know, I mean, just give it even a time period, like a week. Give it to God over and over again in a week, and see if after a week, if you don't feel differently, if you don't actually have a sense of breathing room to be able to actually work through it in a better way. And then the third thing, I don't know if we got a third point up there. Did we get a third point? We did. Just to listen to people. After we have some space to be able to interact with ourselves in a way that we are not all like tense about something, then we actually can interact with other people as well. We actually can ask them questions, you know, not just what you believe, but why do you believe that? Often as you find out why people believe certain things, and even why you believe certain things, you start being able to find points of connection. You know, often you even find you have the same reason to believe something. You're doing it to the Lord as they're doing the opposite thing to the Lord. So even if you disagree about how to do it, you're doing it for the same reason. Or if it's not the same reason, at least you can understand or respect why they're doing certain things. If you get to the why behind having a difference in an issue, it really allows you to actually to work through the issues together. As Nigel was saying, you know, come together and have that conversation. You know, learn from each other, listen to each other, connect with each other well. Would you stand? I'd like to pray for us just to have that type of heart and have that type of experience. God, I invite your spirit to come. And as Nigel was sharing this poem about this idea of warming our hearts, God, next to the fire of truth, of kindness. God, certainly we don't want our bodies to be any warmer. But, God, I do pray for a sense of our spirits, our souls, just to come alive and to be awakened. And to experience more than we've experienced so far, God. That we don't get stuck in any of the ruts of being in one camp or another camp and, you know, connected to one party or one issue or one, you know, point of view. God, in the end, that we trust you to actually work things out, that you're the judge and you'll figure things out. God, I pray for this series that we would be able to have, like, you know, good, meaningful interaction with you this week and these upcoming weeks, as well as with each other. That there would be, you know, problems between roommates and friends and marriages and all kinds of different relationships, God, that actually we'd be able to learn and hear each other's points of view and understand ourselves all the better and actually to maybe not resolve the issue but have unity. And that, God, if my friend is right, that actually would be the strongest kind of relationship that is possible. God, I pray for you to bless our relationships here, our families and our friendships and our unity of our church as well as our unity of all churches and all people. Pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.